Welcome back to Campbell Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell, and today is episode 218 of the podcast, and I'm joined in conversation by David McIntosh. David is a management consultant listed in the Business Insider 35 Under 35, the founder of the UK social mobility network, KPMG, and of course, better known as the host of the Development by David podcast. I've gotten to know David really well over the last 3 years, and it's only in the last few weeks that I've actually learned the true extent of David's childhood and his start point in life. I was exposed to the actualized, focused, and accomplished version that you get to hear today, but life was not always like that for David, and the likelihood of the positive trajectory that he's now on was not certain by any means at all. In today's episode, you can expect to learn about David's life and mindset growing up in Prestwick, his struggles fitting in at school and in life, and feeling the weight and burden of shame around his circumstances. But if you've been exposed to any of David's content before, you'll know that he's a huge proponent of personal responsibility and agency. With that in mind, you're going to hear the levers and tools that David used to empower himself to transform the traumas that he suffered into sources of strength. He will offer advice to you to support you in battling shame, fear, confusion that's rooted in sometimes in your upbringing. And you'll also enjoy insights that we discuss together on how to build confidence and competence. Today's podcast is sponsored and supported by Vibe, because of course it could be. Vibe have been a massive support to myself and David with both our own podcasts, and they are an international nutrition brand at the very forefront of leveling up human performance. Many of you will have seen me share the Vibe on my story in the morning when I'm having a quick and easy breakfast, when I'm getting to start work on my laptop, but Vibe goes far beyond that. It has its meal shakes, it has its ability for you to hit your protein and get in a lot of nutrients, but it also is working on a greens powder, which has been instrumental in me improving my health. Nobody, and I can put this like in certain terms, is eating enough fruit and vegetables. I certainly amn't and wasn't. So having a quality greens powder to cover those bases for me has been absolutely vital. And of course, the one that gets the most replies when I share it on Instagram is Vibe's Nootropic, which is lion's mane mushroom. You can get it as a powder or a capsule. And in the powder, you can pop it into like a tea or a coffee, or you can mix your own with just hot water. But I personally have the capsules alongside my other supplements. I am running so fast at this moment in time. I'm about to fly out to Dubai. I'm really excited for some of the podcasts I've got out there and some of the different projects I'm working on alongside my day job and my career, launching the podcast masterclass. I need to be at my very best. So fueling myself with the right things like the greens powder, like lion's mane, has been fundamental for me. And you can do the exact same and get 15% off by using the code CAMPOD at the link in the show notes. Before we get into this episode, I want to say a massive thank you to David for his raw insights on the loss of his mother, his experience of stand-up comedy, the full circle moments of interviewing Sir Tom Hunter, speaking at his old secondary school, and so much more. I'm very, very grateful to him. And I hope you all enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed recording it. If you are new here, make sure you've hit that subscribe and follow button. I've got some incredible episodes coming up in the next couple of weeks, including ones that I'll be recording on tour out in Dubai. Thank you for your support. The music's about to play, and you have an hour and a half with myself and Mr. David McIntosh. David, welcome to the show. I'm excited this one's finally happening.
Mate, I'm excited too. I said to you before we came into the studio, I sent you a screenshot of our first messages in 2019. And I started as a fan, then a follower, and then a listener, and now I'm on the podcast. So this is really full circle for me. I know I've been on previously, but I've never been on to tell my story or my own kind of unique insight. So
yeah, exactly that. We had that kind of fun roundtable episode with Darren when he flew in from Singapore like December 2022,
yeah,
which was great. And as you say, we've known each other at different varying levels over the years. And I think that's really, really cool as well. And some of the things we're going to speak about in terms of role models and networking connection, I think it's going to tie in quite nicely to that side of things. But we probably became closest after you started your own podcast, the Development of David podcast. And the kind of mission statement of that is using origin stories to support people as a self-development tool. And with that in mind, I want to go into your origin story and understand a bit more about where David McIntosh came from and how you've developed over the years to be the man that I get to sit beside today.
That's a pleasure. I was reading a quote in a book the other day, and it was, there's no greater agony than an untold story. And after 99 episodes of my own podcast, I've just recently shared mine for the first time, and it felt so self-indulgent. Being here with you feels somewhat self-indulgent. But I realised that no matter whether it's the homeless gent on the street or the guy that serves you coffee in the morning to people that come on our podcast, all stories have lessons and hold weight. And I'm really excited to be on your platform, 200 episodes. And I think it's a really great point where you're at now. And I think you've always been mentally there as well in terms of how generous you've been with your platform. But you give conditions and space for people who are in your friendship group or people who don't really have as big of a platform for you. And you give them a hand up by letting them share their stories and their insights instead of just being fame hungry and chasing the Dr. Arias of the world, for example. Like, it's nice that you are building this platform and turning back and leaving out a hand for me. And you've done that since we first started speaking as well, when you were 10, 20, 30, 50 episodes. And that's been kind of one of the foundations of our relationship, is this kind of, no, like, we're not in competition with each other. We've always said that. And it's just really nice that I'm back on the podcast this time sharing my story, which is very aligned to my mission statement, which is to use origin stories as a self-development tool. And I'm excited to get into it.
It's so cool, isn't it? And I think, not to go super podcast bro, because many of the listeners that listen to this one don't have their own podcast or have desires to have their own podcast, but coming with an abundance mindset to this space should give people encouragement into the other areas that they spend their time in and they work within and they strive within, that you aren't always in competition with people that are doing the same thing as you. And I mentioned we did that roundtable podcast with Darren, and we share a group chat called Podcast Level Up, and we bounce ideas around on equipment, on software, but probably more important than that, we bounce introductions around on guests. And some of the great guests that we've had for two young guys from like the west coast of Scotland has been incredible in terms of a global stage, and that's been more possible because we're doing the work together. And I think that's a really healthy thing for people to realize, that you don't necessarily have to be dog eat dog, and we're both fiercely competitive in the different domains that we work within, but you don't need to try and push somebody down to put yourself up. And again, people will be laughing down their AirPods or through their car radio, wherever they listen to this, but I talk about a rising tide raises all ships all the time. And one of the first things that I started doing when I started journaling and I was trying to improve my own self-talk in at the very start of the kind of lockdown period was talking about being a winner and helping other people to win. And my actions have tried to align with that identity. And as much as possible, that has been the case. And a winner and a rising tide has some similarities.
Yeah, and in the west coast of Scotland or in Glasgow, there is literally no competition. There's so much room for us both. And we're kind of in two different realms in terms of the format of our podcasts. I think Stephen Bartlett and Chris Williamson spoke about this, and I kind of see synergies between you and I. You're in the business of purveying and sharing ideas and concepts and theories and education, whereas I'm in the business of sharing stories and transformation. So they don't really kind of directly compete, but by nature of you sharing ideas and knowledge and concepts and theory, that usually comes with storytelling underneath it that backs it. But then again, when I share stories and transformations, sometimes I try and like wrap it around with a theme or a lesson.
An actionable point. Yeah, 100%. And I think that's the beauty of these things. And I guess with that in mind, I think we're going to achieve that in today's discussion. But let's go to your origin story, David. Let's go where it all starts.
I always love to give a nod to my parents because we'll probably speak about social mobility, and intergenerational social mobility is such a kind of pertinent theme within the terms of social mobility. So my dad, he grew up in Kilmarnock. You might have listeners there, you might not, but Kilmarnock has been known for the documentary The Scheme, yep, which was basically a poverty safari showcasing the deprivation of a single town and almost creating it in such light that it looked like a poverty pornography or a fetishization of...
It was borderline comedy, but tragic.
It was hugely tragic, and if you kind of examine the trajectories of those people, their lives haven't got much better. So my dad grew up in that area, Kilmarnock, and at the time he grew up in an environment that looked like a Willy Wonka's story, right? Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Like, he shared the same bed as his five other siblings. He was the oldest of six, and he grew up in an environment where his dad was an alcoholic, a veteran, and that will be pertinent to my story when I kind of move forward. But he grew up in an abusive household where the father figure was very dominant. His dad was an alcoholic, suffered every aftermath of conflict or war. He began to become a man at a very young age, having paper rounds from the age of 8, milk bottle runs, ginger bottle runs from the age of 8 all the way to 15, 16, where he would provide all these all the earnings from that to my family to keep them afloat. And there's times whereby my dad couldn't go to school because he was beaten black and blue from his dad, like black eyes and such things. And there's times where the neighbours had to take him in for respite and for care. That was the closest to being part of the care system that my dad experienced. And he then found himself as any kind of lost man joining the army, the British Armed Forces and the Scots Guards, joined as a private and had an amazing experience there because he found his real brothers. He felt a sense of family for the first time and discipline and control and routine and safe conditions. But then that obviously exacerbated when he, or changed when he went to the Falklands War. He slept in trenches and had to piss on his feet to keep himself warm at night. He slept in barns in the Falkland Islands and watched his comrades die in front of him. I'm reminded of a story where he told me that he pulled the boots off a dead Argentinian to keep himself warm because his boots were frozen. And just hearing those conditions and his starting point in life really makes me aware of when I call myself disadvantaged, because I had all the advantages that he had. So when he left the army, he suffered from PTSD and depression, and to medicate that, he didn't have access to therapy. He didn't have money for therapy. That was very much a luxury or a delight or a kind of material.
It was beyond his means.
Way beyond his means. And he probably wasn't even aware of it, never mind having financial means to access it. So he kind of medicated with alcoholism quite early on. I hear stories before I was born about how he was always kind of fond of the drink. And I sympathize with that, because anyone who had been through what he had been through probably would do the same. So that was his upbringing. And my mum's upbringing was very similar. She was the youngest of six, and she didn't leave the family nest till her 30s. They lived in a large but poor family. And my grand stayed at home. My papa, he was a window cleaner and had very kind of ordained jobs in that way. And they were always encouraged, especially as a woman in that era, that they would leave school and get a job as soon as possible. So both my parents were very uneducated academically. So they kind of got together through kind of luck or spontaneity when they both worked in Craig Tara, the holiday park, when that was such a thing. And they came together and bought their first house. It was a wee one-bed flat in a kind of deprived area of air. And when I was born a twin, and I was born 6 to 8 weeks premature. I almost died, and my twin, of course, didn't quite make it. And I spent so much time in an incubator, 6 to 8 weeks, where my family couldn't touch me. I weighed 2 pounds, and my dad lost his job during that process because he had to be so attentive to my mum, who also almost died having me. So I guess my entry into this world, both from my parents' upbringing and then my own, was quite tough to begin with. So growing up, I always felt ostracized, either whether that was through my own perception of myself or through actual circumstances from the tribe. I never felt like I could fit in because my clothes weren't the same. My ability to go on school trips wasn't the same because we didn't have the money for it. I was quite overweight as a child because we didn't have nutritional education in the household. And my mom and dad didn't really have that. And I just found myself becoming a huge recluse quite early on. And coupled with that, quite a challenging environment at home, living with someone that suffered from alcohol addiction, you kind of have no paternal role model. As much as my dad is a total war hero to me, and there's so many traits that come along with that that I have embodied, like a resilience, cheerfulness and adversity and such on. When you go home to an environment where you see only one version of your dad and that's predominantly drunk, you don't really feel like you have a dad. So that was hugely a struggle. But not only that, there was quite a lot of animosity in the household, to put it lightly.
Confrontation between the two.
Between my mum and my dad, because they weren't together because they wanted to be together. It was just kind of misfortune or kind of alignment or kind of settlement.
Duty is a big thing as well.
Duty as well.
So if you bring a child or two children as your sister as well into the world, there is an element of, particularly in that generation, a duty to stay together, to support.
Especially when you have little financial provisions and little capital at home. You don't own your own house, you just kind of stay together for the kids. So there's a lot of confrontation in the house. They were arguing most nights, and that was alcohol fueled. And I remember vividly, because my dad was this kind of hard-nosed Kilmarnock veteran, he never really showed physical affection or emotion towards me. And the only way that I could gain his validation wasn't through academic achievement, because I didn't really understand or validate that.
It wasn't something he'd appreciated himself, so it's less relatable for him to say, oh, David did this in this class.
Yeah, like he didn't know what algebra or trigonometry was, or didn't, he couldn't string a sentence in French. Probably couldn't string a sentence in good English, never mind French. I had to use humour to deflect that. But that academic capability wasn't really rewarded. Good behaviour in school wasn't really rewarded, because I think that was determined as a default, if anything, because I was quite silent in school anyway. And the only way I could really side my dad was by following his opinions and his morals and sticking up for him when there was confrontation in the house. And he would do and say things that were very misaligned to someone that I am now. But at that age, having lust and having this need for my dad's validation, the closest thing I could do was to side by him. And there was vivid moments where I was scared as a kid, very scared. And I would go against my own morality. And what that manifested itself in is not having a voice at such a young age and not having a core set of values. And there was times where, because they were unemployed, there was times where I had to lie a lot as a kid as well, because I didn't fit in. I would lie about the holidays I went on. I remember this funny story. We got a veteran charity supported trip to Weymouth Bay and the west coast of Scotland, and no one had ever been there that I grew up with. But also none of my friends had been to Malta. So I took a couple of pictures and said to my friends I had been in Malta, because I was so embarrassed by the nature of the holidays that we had. And that conditioned me to live by an archetype that wasn't me. And that was very difficult. And I guess they were the kind of early kind of memories that I have. And there's simple things like eating my lunch under the stairs at school because I was too scared to integrate into friendship groups because I was so embarrassed by how I looked. And also my vernacular and my accent as well was very slang at the time. And it's very different to the person I am now because I like to read and I like to speak. But I also had a speech impediment. I mumbled a lot. I stuttered a lot. That, with my body shame plus my household environment, I just didn't want to integrate into friendship groups, which is very different to the person I am now. So that was kind of the earlier.
That's what I was about to say. Different, like such a different character. And the character you are now went through all those experiences. And it's a case of, and I guess we'll come to this, perhaps how you interpreted those experiences at that moment in time, which meant that you behaved in the way that you did. So for example, when you told me about eating lunch by yourself at school and stuff like that, like it's so radically different to the David that I know over the last 3 years, who is pretty extroverted, yes, happy in your own company and content and not needy, but always willing to try and make a social effort. So for you to be constrained by the different things that you had going on in your life and your environment at that moment in time and not to behave in the way that I see you now, it's really interesting how these things weigh more heavily, particularly at a young age.
Indeed, and I think that's why storytelling is so important, because by nature of social media, we can take images of someone at a snapshot in time. So people would look at me on Instagram doing stand-up comedy and having a podcast and think, oh, it must be nice. It must be so nice to be so confident and somewhat arrogant to step on stage or have a podcast. But it's not always been that, and it's taking little repetitions to get me to here. It's not been like an overnight transformation. Yes, there has been key pivots in my life that have unlocked a new abundant mindset that's allowed me to make those incremental changes. However, it hasn't been overnight, and I really embrace my story now, and I'm not ashamed of those experiences. And I reflect, if maybe my life took a radical left turn and I kind of succumbed to the outcomes of someone that would typically belong or be born into my environment, which could involve crime or theft or low paid employment or unemployment or alcoholism or addiction or any of these other kind of tropes that kind of surround
potential
the
pitfalls.
If I went that way, I don't think I would be so comfortable in identifying those experiences and talking about them so openly. It's only because I have transformed for the positive that I don't have shame about those experiences and those tendencies growing up. And I'm very lucky to be here on a podcast sharing my story. This is miles, if not hundreds of miles away from what I ever thought would be the outcome of my life. But I guess it's only because it's some sort of like survivorship bias. Like the only reason I'm talking about it is because I've survived.
Your story's being amplified because of what you've achieved now and how you're able to communicate it. Whereas the people that don't come out of the circumstances from which you were in, they're much less likely to have a light shone on their story, unless it's through things like the scheme where they are wheeled out for the entertainment of the BBC viewers.
Yeah, and at times they might blame their circumstances or their happenstances for ending up in those environments. And I think they do play a huge factor. But I am a case study, and I hope the other people that have been on my podcast across different walks of life are evidence that your background doesn't dictate your outcomes, and you can take personal responsibility. You can have agentic control over your life. Yes, it may be harder, and yes, there's studies that the academic outcomes of your parents does affect the academic outcome of you. Your health outcomes of your parents affect the health outcomes of you. Even the criminality of your parents affects the criminality of yourself. Yes, there's strong correlations between the two, but that isn't the narrative that I want to push. I don't want to say that because you're from a certain background, you must succumb to these certain beliefs and expectations, and there's a class ceiling that holds you off from your biggest aspirations. I want to be living proof that, yes, you can go through these things, and they can be your superpower that propel you on to do greater things. And there's a quote that I always have to write down before podcasts because there's so many great words in it that I always stumble across, and it's from Dr. Meg J, who's been a guest on your show and a guest on my show. She quotes Abigail Adams and says, "Habits of a vigorous mind are formed in contending with great difficulty. When a mind is raised by scenes that engage the heart, then those qualities that would otherwise lay dormant waken to life and form the character of a superhero." And it just shows that there's so much weight and power in these hard times. And if you have this personal, responsible, agentic mindset, you can actually gain competitive advantage over those who haven't been through those experiences by tapping into them and using them as your weapon of victory instead of your, I guess, weapon of victimhood.
The terms you're using are so powerful, but I'm thinking like David under the stairs, going home to a relatively unhappy household, like not engaging with his peers, not engaging with the academic system, because if we like listen to the way you speak now and listen to the concepts you're interested in, you clearly have a flair for education of oneself, whether that's in a traditional academic setting or not, that doesn't really matter. But I'm just trying to understand like how it must be so difficult for somebody that's in that level of circumstance and feeling downtrodden to then flip the switch, to use the language that you're using, which is so confident about a traditional phrase, but the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. You were just like, well, that's not going to be the case for me. My apple is going to be nowhere near under this tree.
And to refer to the term social mobility, like the textbook definition or the OECD definition or whatever, is usually something along the lines of the movement between people between social class or social strata. Social class is quite arbitrary. And I don't quite like this textbook definition. I quite like using this individualistic definition, which is the amount of ease or friction between an individual and their awareness, therefore access to opportunity. And we often hear this term, equal access to opportunity or equal opportunity. And that's great. But you need to be aware of the opportunity before you can even begin to fathom your path to access. And for me, if I were to really reflect that concept in my own story, and where the kind of first mental pivot took place was when Sir Tom Hunter came to my high school. And for context sake, Sir Tom Hunter is a global philanthropist, but is also known as previous Scottish richest man. And he was on like the Sunday Times rich list. And he came into my school in Prestwick in the West Coast, and I remember him wearing his kind of brazen suit and these like flashy white Nikes. And he jumped on stage, full of energy, full of beans, full of chutzpah, and said these quotes that kind of lacerated my brain, which was like, be a radiator and not a drain. And that stuck with me because it's talking about how despite your outcomes, you have, despite your environment, you have the locus of control to be positive and to be optimistic and to be hopeful and to be aspirational. And yes, that could be disillusional or it could be contrary to your environment, but at least it's helpful disillusion. And I remember him saying that. And he also said, it's better to ask for forgiveness than beg for permission. And that really instilled this permissionless mindset in me. And what I mean by that is that in my local area, and I'm going to use an example, which is the kind of second hard pivot in my life. So for context sake, after that, I felt super powered by having such a relatable role model so close to home. I started selling tablet around the street and had...
Before we go on to that, David, can I just ask why Sir Tom, as an individual in particular, resonated so strongly versus, say, another speaker that maybe came to the school the year before or the year after?
Yeah, and I remember the one either the year before or the year after was the group CEO or the CEO of STV Group. And he didn't really have a relatable story. He wasn't even from my location. He was from England, I think. And he went through a very different upbringing, which is totally fine. That story holds merit to those people that speaks to. But it just didn't speak to me in the same way Sir Tom Hunter's story spoke to me. And that's because even despite his kind of white, straight white man, rich, suited persona, I thought, well, he's definitely from a different demographic than me. But in fact, he was from New Kilnock, which is a mining town a few miles away from my own. And he started by selling like groceries from the back of his dad's van and sold like Reebok trainers at the Air Sunday market. So because it was so relatable and so close and so tangible, it didn't make me think, right, I'm going to be the next Sir Tom Hunter. But it made me think, well, if he can do something that's as extreme as that from his upbringing, then at least my life can get marginally better. I can reach beyond the parapet. Or
if he's at Z, then maybe I'll get to H or J or even fucking D would be good, wouldn't it?
B would be great, honestly.
Yeah.
The amount of pain that I was going through and my sister was going through as a child because of the financial anxiety and financial depression and therefore anxiety and depression that was going on in my household was painstaking. It was horrible. And the inner monologue and self-talk that I had because of the shame that surrounded those environments was painstaking and horrible. And if anything could get better, whether it was just the idea of maybe even going to a college or getting an apprenticeship program or doing better at school or having a kind of positive feedback, look, even B on the alphabet would have been so much better than what was going on. So yeah, that was hugely important to me. And I always joke, and it's a true story, when I went back to my high school to tell this story and the kids laughed, I ran back to my desk at school in my business class and tried to Google, like, what is an entrepreneur? What's a philanthropist? Nothing came up because I couldn't even spell the words. And that gave me insight into what an entrepreneur was, like self-sufficiency, being an innovator, creating wealth, whether that's financial or non-financial. I learned what an entrepreneur was, but also learned what a philanthropist was, what it's like to build something so big that you have an abundance of capital or money or whatever else
that you can use to drag people in your direction.
And that kind of gave this, and it's kind of, if you look at my own story and where I am now, I've done that to my own degree. I work a 9-to-5, I have a salary, I'm not rich, but I have a platform that I use to, like you did to me today, lean back and give a hand. So that really instilled my first kind of set of values. When we were speaking, I didn't really have much values. That really instilled maybe a glimpse or a flavor or a smell of what could happen next. And
like a genuine role model.
A genuine role. And it was relatable as well, mate. It wasn't like a David Beckham or a Ronaldinho at the time. It was so close to home. And I don't think he realized at the time how powerful his speech was. And I don't think many of the kids were interested in his speech, to be honest. Obviously, there was one person that really kind of latched onto him at that moment in time. And only when he came back on the podcast...
Were you able to tell him?
I was able to tell him. And he didn't realize the amount of weight that his story had. And that encouraged him to do more of that stuff.
Yeah, it's huge, isn't it? And if you're thinking back to young David looking up at Sir Tom Hunter, that is a real catalyst moment for shifting from the David under the stairs, cowering, not engaging, ashamed, uninspired, to a closer version to what I get to talk to now.
Yeah, and I guess that's the beauty of social media now, is that children just like me, and hopefully my platform serves as one vehicle for this, but I hope there's millions of others, they can look online and not look at the Victoria's Secret models or the Ant Index on social media or these kind of primetime TV stars, right? But they can look at someone like you or someone like me and think, well, they're not too dissimilar to me. They're a couple of rungs above me on the ladder. What have they done to get to where they're at, how can I replicate some of those steps to get me to a horizon that's a bit better than where I'm just now? Or use them as decision-making models when they're going through tough times. What would Cole think if he was posed with this opportunity to go in this work experience, to experience this industry? What would David do if he was going through this painstaking environment? Would he move out or would he stay at home? Would he break up with that girl? Would he not? And I think social media has allowed greater insights into the workings of our role models' minds. And those role models are more relatable than they were ever before. Because before, in my dad's generation and your dad's generation, it probably was film stars, Roger Moore, Bond cast and stuff that would be their role models. But now we have micro role models and relatable role models that are a bit closer to home.
Yeah, we do. Social media's got so many pitfalls, but one of the biggest pros is, of course, networking. But actually, you almost feel like you're connecting to an online role model, and so many people can maybe point out that, oh, I consume all of this guy's stuff and I love what he says about this, this, this. And you're like, okay, brilliant. Because you would never have had access to that in the past. As you were saying, you would have maybe seen Roger Moore at the cinema, but he's playing a role.
Yeah.
He's playing a character. Whereas you, I mean, a lot of people on social media are playing a character. I'm sure we can get into that. But many other people are just sharing their process. So like Hormozy is probably one of the most well-known at the moment, where so many people are getting to see behind the scenes of how somebody just relentlessly scales businesses and what advice he's giving. And massive chunks of it are free, which is wild. And I did a podcast episode in the studio with a kind of semi-regular roundtable guest, David Hatton, Chris Burns, called Stand on the Shoulders of Giants. And that was all based on the access that we have now to information that we wouldn't have had before. So even from a potentially disadvantaged background, you still maybe would have the internet access at school to consume and watch information from these guys. And that, I guess that's probably more current now, but even back then there were still some opportunities to like, okay, I'm going to delve into this person's information.
And I think that is the core difference between the outcomes of my parents and the outcomes of myself, is that I really think that access to aspiration on tap was such a pivot for me. I often think about Gary Vaynerchuk. I listened to his podcast before podcasts were a thing. I remember going into school under the stairs or whatever else, listening to Ask Gary V, and dialers would phone in and ask Gary Vaynerchuk. You should give him a search. He's a kind of polarizing figure. A lot of his messages are great. A lot of them are a bit accentuated and hyperbolic, I guess.
He's very American, but yeah, some of what he says will strike true.
But if you're a disadvantaged young people and he's saying you can have access to whatever you want, you can have the lifestyle that you want, as long as you work hard and delay gratification and you're patient, like, that's obviously going to speak to someone who was so fragile like me at that age. And I remember his style of podcast was Ask Gary Vee. So phoners or dialers would phone in and ask a question. And you could actually see the user manual that he would use to provide and prescribe advice to these people. And just like Hormozy, you could see the inner workings of his brain. And that gave me such a weird competitive advantage at that age. Because no one was listening to stuff like that, especially at the age of 14, 15, 16. And I think a tangible kind of takeaway for maybe listeners who, and I don't really presume that people that are listening to you are lost, because they've found you, and I think you're a really good role model for them. If not, the people that you have on are really great role models and speak to them. But if they are feeling a bit lost, what do you want to do? Who's doing that thing? And just start reaching out to them. And one thing that I would love to demonstrate on this podcast is, when I was looking through the messages to you, mate, this is before you, this is maybe around episode one of yours, I said something to you like, oh, Cole, it's so nice that you replied to me. You didn't need to do this. I think it's really warm that you've done something like this. And then you replied like something along the lines of, oh, don't worry about that. I'm not here to build followers. I'm here to interact and reach those who already follow me and help them. And that's crazy. That's such a core tenet of you and how consistent that is to right now. So yeah, I just wanted to eliminate that.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I think I've always wanted a deeper following than a wider one. Mm-hmm. And even pre-podcast, when I was primarily creating like fitness / lifestyle / self-development content that wasn't as broad as a show like this one, I wanted people to feel the positive impact of it. And I'm sure you've said similar before, but a message is worth far more than 100 downloads. A DM about how something's impacted them is well worth more than however many views on a reel or a TikTok. It's so much more valuable to hear how something has gone beyond just a touch point or another notch on the on the download count or the listen count. And I would always rather hear what it meant to somebody. And don't get me wrong, there's been a few times, and I'm talking a very few, when the podcast has gone absolutely bananas with a particular guest or two, where it's been hard for me to reply. Yeah. But I genuinely have always like time boxed time to go back to those, because it is fuel for the fire as well. Like, so David saying to me episode one, wow, what a great episode that was, I learned this. Of course I'm replying to that, because it spurred me on to keep going past episode 10 and episode 20 and however many other milestones that people fall over at one of the show.
And it's crazy how much people still hold on to some of the lessons that they learn from like an episode one. Like The Forgotten Highlander is still like a core book that I revisit two or three times a year, and that was mentioned in that podcast
with Chris and I.
It has so much longevity, these tips and these stories and the advice that you give. And it's crazy when you get a message from someone who's listened to like episode one or episode five or episode six, and it just shows the things that we say stand the test of time as well. And we're not doing it for virality or short form content. And yeah, I'm maybe a bit more clickbait with you than you with most recent titles with the High School Shooter and stuff like that, but I love,
you're still trying to achieve something from the episode though, that has
always long form, right? And I'm just glad that our work stands the test of time. And that means that people who are going through what maybe I went through, they don't need to go onto TikTok and see the most up-to-date content to develop. They can go into the archives. It's why autobiographies are so popular, right? They really stand the test of time. Stories are the only thing that really bond humans, in my opinion. And there's a reason why also fiction is so popular as well. People love stories. And you don't need to be on TikTok listening to the most up-to-date stuff to advance yourself. You can go into the archives and listen to a Tim Cook or a Steve Jobs, I mix the names up there, or a Richard Branson or whatever you're interested in. You don't need to...
And you can find inspiration from these guys. Yeah, I love that. So let's go back to your story where you've been inspired by Sir Tom and you decide to start baking tablet.
Baking tablet fudge. With help from my mum. She was in the kitchen. She was on operations. I was on selling and distribution. But yeah, it was just that experience with Sir Tom Hunter gave me this insight into what a better life could look like. And of course, at the age of 11 or 12, I couldn't start a new dating app or start the new hot fitness brand like Gymshark, right? The closest thing I had was a kitchen and some raw materials. So I started just going around the local council estate selling tablet and fudge, and I wasn't an accountant at the time, so I probably made a net loss. But a really vivid pivot happened just shortly after that, when I visited my uncle and my auntie, my uncle Neil and my auntie Lynn, and I had the change from the paper round and the tablet selling in my hand, and I was just counting it out, coppers by coppers and 10 pences here and there. And he said to me, David, you're good at counting that money. You could be an accountant. They make a lot of money. And in retrospect, and I'm only post-rationalizing this over the last couple of years when I started to really accept my story and understand it, is that that was so, maybe, I don't want to say the most prominent pivot in my life, but it held so much weight. And it's because it gave me visibility of a career that I didn't know existed. Because in my local council estate, everyone was a mechanic or a blue-collar worker or a carer, cleaner, or dinner lady like my mum was. It gave me a different insight into a career that I didn't know. Or
a professional
as well. Something that at the time I didn't know would improve my social mobility. But not only that, he validated skills that I didn't know I had. And I thought reading and arithmetic and mathematics was, or just any sort of academic endeavor, was the preserve of the posh. I didn't realize that you could be from my background and be aspirational and academic. So it made me realize that, oh, I am actually quite good at these core competencies. Maybe I should continue to develop them. Maybe I can be aspirational. Maybe I can be academic. And so you've validated those capabilities, and those capabilities hold weight in the marketplace. But last but not least, and I've only came to grips with this most recently, is that he told me accountants make a lot of money. And I didn't have much money. My entire family's mental health conditions were predicated on their lack of financial security.
An income problem.
Yeah, an income problem. And that, there's no greater motivator than pain or survival. So that combined was like a answer. Tom Hunter was like a supercharge. And only a few weeks later, if not a few months, I was just out in the council estate and I was in my next door neighbor's house, and I just remember this so vividly. Funnily enough, Ant and Dec was on a Saturday night where I would often go into their houses, because what was going on at home, the animosity, the vitriol, I liked being on sleepover almost. Like, I didn't have interaction. Like, I was over at a kind of care support charity the other day with my friend Darren Connell, and they were speaking about, oh, have you been through the care system? And I think, well, no, I haven't. But I often love sleepovers at my friend's house, and that was kind of my closest interaction.
Escapism.
And that is very similar to my dad's, which is very peculiar. But I remember being there, and the mum said to me, oh, David, what do you want to be when you grow up, or what job do you want to have? And she expected astronaut or
football
or something like beyond something that was realistic but aspirational. Or she thought I would reply something like mechanic or something close to home, but never this weird aspirational middle ground when I said, I'm going to be an accountant. And she shot me down to size. Me and you talk about tall poppy syndrome quite a lot. She kind of spat me back down to size and said, well, David, your mom and dad like don't have school hires or whatever else, or they didn't go to university. How will you be an accountant? Pick something a bit more realistic. And we often talk about tall poppy syndrome from a kind of example of our friends or kind of people our age shooting us down to size when we do something a bit nomadic. But it's weird seeing that intergenerational tall poppy syndrome. And I know she was doing it from a place of psychological safety. She wanted my expectations to probably marry the outcomes that she expected of me.
Let's manage them for you, David. Don't want you getting hurt.
Yep. Pick something realistic. But for me, that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I had these capabilities validated by a role model, and I had a relatable role model in Sir Tom Hunter. So what that instilled for me was a kind of feeling of biting down on the proverbial gum shield. And I remember actually saying, fuck you, I'll do what I can. And that was the catalyst for me going on to being quite academic in school and reaching out to support systems that would support people like me, and then ultimately going on work experience that changed my life for the better.
Yeah, before we go into that work experience, Spite is one hell of a driver.
Yeah.
And because you had, and I've heard you speak about this before, because you had the validation of your skills by your uncle and the role model, you had something for that put down to bounce off.
Mm-hmm.
If those two, or perhaps even at least one of those, hadn't been there, then you would have been more vulnerable to lowering your expectations, lowering your ideas, conforming. So I completely understand the importance that you place in the roles that you do nowadays in providing role models, in providing a support system, in providing a validation of a skill set for young people from disadvantaged backgrounds, because if they don't have those, they will revert to the mean. Yeah. They will drop their standards. They will happily be chopped down as a tall poppy within their poppy field, because it's much easier to conform when you don't have those things to back you up and give you that tiny bit of, no, it's okay, I've got this.
Yeah, entirely. And again, it goes back to my definition of social mobility, the amount of ease or friction between an individual and their awareness, therefore access to opportunity. In that moment, there was a lot of friction, a lot of psychological friction. And because my uncle gave me that awareness of opportunity, and so did my distant role model, Sir Tom Hunter, in terms of the world of entrepreneurialism, that close the gap of the friction. And again, like you said, the reason my podcast exists is to show that you can create those pivots for yourself. Mine was sporadic and spontaneous and serendipitous, but I really am curious about how I take what I've been through and the stories of those I get to interact with by nature of my day job, and then people that I interact with by nature of the podcast, understanding what the pivots are and how do we deliver that as a solution for those people.
Yeah.
Again, that all aligns with self-sovereignty and personal responsibility and agentic control. No one's going to give them handouts. The only thing that we can give them is hand-ups, and that's through our own stories and our own lessons.
Yeah, do you know that? I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions with social mobility, and it's why when you speak about it, I prefer it to maybe some of the stuff that I see on LinkedIn, which is a little bit more
systematic and political.
The system is so flawed. The Tories this, the Tories that, or the capitalists are putting us all down, and you're like, oh God, like this is really heavy and hard to get through. Whereas you are fundamentally talking about actionable tools, which any right thinking person is like, I completely agree with that. And that should be available. I completely agree that that should be a thing. It's not a case of like robbing Peter to pay Paul. It's like, oh no, let's build tools that people can utilize and be raised up through this, rather than like putting somebody else down to get somebody else up.
Yeah. and I'm largely apolitical at the moment.
I think I feel politically homeless, and we've talked about this. Nobody really represents us.
Exactly, and if I were to preface this chat with, oh, I'm into social mobility, people would probably think I'm this radical leftist or I vote a certain party. But in fact, I don't. There's aspects of all parties that I kind of incorporate into my day-to-day living. And if I were to subscribe my outcomes to the decisions made by political parties, I would always be met with dissatisfaction. And if my outcomes were to be worsened for whatever policy that had been made, I would be like, well, that's their fault, that's the Tories' fault, that's Lib Dems' fault, or Labour or SNP or whatever else. And I would never take personal responsibility or self-improve. But also if I got a hand out, opposed to a hand up by a certain charity, say, for example, I got ushered into a organisation not on merit, but on like a kind of open
affirmative
space.
Action, yeah. Place. Yeah, I can. It doesn't feel the same.
Feel the same. I wouldn't feel rewarded for getting in there.
Can we talk about the opportunity that you got then to go to London? And I believe it was the first time you'd left Scotland.
It was. It was the first time I had left Scotland. So growing up, I had caravan holiday all over Scotland. And I got this opportunity from an amazing charity called the Social Mobility Foundation. I hope you don't mind that I shout them out. Ran by their CEO, who I'm close friends with now, Sarah Atkinson. Their charity provides access and awareness to opportunity through work experience trips, internships, university support, apprenticeship support, CV writing workshops, personal statement writing workshops, mentoring and everything else in between. And they took me from the west coast of Scotland, where I hadn't left, to London for the first time. They gave me money to dress myself in a nice Primark suit, and they gave me living expenses to live at Queen Mary University Halls. And I had never been to London before. I didn't really know what to expect besides London Eye, Buckingham Palace and Big Ben. And I remember going into Canary Wharf, which was an area that I didn't know existed before. It was kind of gatekept from my knowledge. And going in there and seeing the skyscrapers and seeing other guys in suits.
The finance bros.
The Gilles at the time and the Ralph Lauren and everything else in between. The people that we are right now, right, are not too far from. Like, it just raised my aspirations. And at first I was kind of hesitant. I thought, well, I don't belong here. Why have they put me here? And then I went into the organization and I got to speak with people that were just like me and much different. And I remember returning. I really can't remember anything technical from that week, to be honest. But what overwhelmed me was the high-flying aspiration that everybody had and the mindset of that their outcomes aren't predetermined by their background. And I just went back to school and I got a skin fade. I lost a bunch of weight and I started dressing in a blazer and put a tie on. And it was like a light bulb moment. I knew working at a place like that was my end goal. And I knew that could be facilitated by this archetype of wanting to be an accountant. And I just became really super academic at school and self-sovereign and agentic. And it was like a life-changing moment. It really was, because I got that representation again so close to home. It wasn't a multimillionaire that I got to meet. It was just other employees who had better life outcomes, who had a company car and got their birthday off and had a salary and weren't financially
went to
insecure.
Work in a suit and semi-enjoyed what they did and talked about it.
And talked about it, yeah. And felt a sense of validation and pride. And they had their own values because of the nature of working at a place like that. So yeah, for me, that was a really close role model or a close, I don't know, goal for me. And an apprenticeship program made sense. I didn't have to go to university. I couldn't really afford to go to university either, like to stay in university halls. And I used to think an apprentice was a kind of a blue collar mechanic.
There's still that association.
Oh, 100%. We feel like
plumber, joiner, a trade basically. And you and one other friend I know quite well, my friend's younger sister, both became chartered accountants at like 21 or what age did you
25.
Qualify? 25, yeah. Well, you qualified at a young age as well, though, compared to what a lot of people would have. And during the time as an apprentice, they bought cars, moved out.
Had holidays,
which, unless you are from a relatively privileged background as a university student, or you are heavily leveraged through the student loan system or the student support system, it's quite unlikely. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually surprised that it's not a more well-trodden path.
Yeah, and it seems to be, I don't know, it seems to have got this archetype of the lesser cousin to university. And I think that is through like media narratives and prehistoric archetypes of when an apprentice is. But
again, school targets as well. Like the Blair government famously wanted 50% of school leavers to go into higher education.
That's
not been changed, or it's probably been accentuated since then. Like the school that I went to, albeit a public school, it was very much considered that you should go to university.
And when I was reading Professor Lee Ellick Major's Social Mobility and What Do We Know About It, he speaks about how I think something like 2/3 of affluent kids go to university and 1/10 of less privileged kids go to university. So I start to think, where does the 9 of the 10 end up? And it is probably these blue collar apprenticeships or trades. So 50% seems to be quite difficult to achieve when 9 out of 10 kids from my background aren't going to university.
Yeah, it's bonkers, isn't it? And I think it's like such a strange measurement to measure people by. And if you look at how like good at your job you are, how well educated you are, and how well spoken you are, like what was the difference between a 4-year degree which would have saddled you with debt and maybe not fulfilled you in the same way and enabled you in the same way versus an apprenticeship which upskilled you within work as well? And if I think about my degree, where yes, I took vast amounts of information and distilled it down into good arguments that I could write and speak, great, but was it really necessary for me to do the career that I'm in now? Probably not.
And I think about my dad's story about being this lost kind of rugrat and then joining the army and becoming polished and having a set of values and actions that are innate to him. My version of that was KPMG, or where I work, my apprenticeship program, because I didn't really know what I wanted to want. I didn't really have this core set of mannerisms and values, and getting ushered into an organization like that through that charity allowed me to, it was my equivalent of joining the army. It gave me discipline. I had to be at work at 9 and finish at 5. I had to do exams. Unlike university, where I could hang out in different social clubs and they were my choices and I could party until 2 a.m. and do fresh and all that good stuff. I don't think I would have done well in that environment because I was already at loose ends at home in terms of I didn't have any parental role models to kind of guide me and shape me and steer me in a certain direction. So if I was let loose, perhaps in university, I probably might have went off the rails. But working in an organization where there's very strict guidelines,
the parameters
and expectations, it really helped me, these kind of guide rails that they had.
Yeah, and you've gone on to achieve so much, and there's like all these accolades that we can list off, and they'll obviously be in the show notes, David, as your bio. But what stands out for you during your time at KPMG that you feel like genuinely proud of?
Again, it's kind of relating back to gaining this validation from my dad. Okay. And it was the opportunity to speak to Her Majesty the Queen in 2020 and share my story. I remember vividly growing up when I first got my job at KPMG as an apprentice. I remember not getting in the first year. I applied and getting in the second year and being elated and crying because I got this kind of what felt like a golden ticket to the rest of my life. And I remember trying to demonstrate my emotions to my parents, but they didn't really understand how much that meant to me because they didn't work in professional services. They didn't understand how big of an organization that was. And they didn't realize how competitive the recruitment processes were to get into a place like that. And I remember them kind of just shaking my hand and being kind of glad for me, but not super emotionally elated. And at the same time, my sister got a part-time job at Boots. And that was met with tears because they could see how important Boots was as an organization, because it'd been in the high street for 100 years. My mom had seen the amazing ladies wearing the white overalls and she cried for my sister. So I wasn't, after that, whether it was exams or departmental recognition or projects that I'd worked on, that wasn't really being validated at home because they didn't really understand it. But meeting the Queen was the first time that my dad could be like, oh, maybe David's doing something that's actually quite admirable. And that's because I had started a social mobility network that helps people within my profession, if not industry, get access to the resources and support that they need to have equal access to opportunity. We're not giving them opportunity, we're giving them the resources that they need to have equal access to opportunity on their own merit. And that came from just sharing my story within the workplace and getting to speak to Her Majesty the Queen in 2020 and having my dad, who has also got that royal affinity through the army guarding Buckingham Palace and Windsor Castle, having him finally kind of give me a nod of like, oh, David, you must
I'm
be
proud of you, son.
Yeah. And he was sharing that far and wide. It was on CNN News and ITV News at 6 when it was released. And him sharing that. And that was really pretty rich for me. I think that was definitely the kind of clickbait highlight for me. But also going back to my high school only a few months ago and being asked to be the guest speaker.
Playing the Sir Tom Hunter role. Like, that is one of the things that when you and I were speaking about us having a chat on this show, you were like, I just need that. Like, I don't need that. I want that full circle moment because it will feel so good to think about the young people in that audience that I might be able to impact in the same way, albeit without the billionaire title of Sir Tom, but with the same story of I was in your position, perhaps worse than some of you. Like, I'm telling you right now, it can get better if you want it to. And if you apply yourself in the way that you have, which is like genuinely inspiring.
Oh, thank you, mate. Thank you. That's really nice to hear. Especially coming from you, like, I look at you as a role model, and you've taught me so much, and we bounce off each other, and having you saying that you're inspired by me is pretty powerful, mate. And going back to my high school and sharing, I quite enjoyed sharing this kind of non-rags to riches story because it just made it more relatable and tangible to them, because I was 25. Sir Tom Hunter was 60 or 55 when he came back to my school. The distance travelled isn't that far. From a tangible point of view, maybe from a psychological point.
The environment's more relatable as well because you had similar technology, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So you can be more like, oh, I had online role models, and people in the crowd are like, understand that. Whereas if Tom Hunter said he had role models that he watched in the pictures when he went there on a Saturday afternoon after selling Reebok shoes off the back of his van, you're kind of like, I get it, but it's not the same.
Applicable, yeah. Yeah. And since then, like, the school has been so complimentary. They said, before I went on stage, oh, Sir Tom Hunter had you and everyone else in the palm of their hand. And then I came off stage and went, oh yeah, you also had everyone else in the palm of your hand. And that felt great just being compared to someone that I used to celebritize and role model so much. And I know we're not, from a financial or business or whatever else point of view, on the same par, but knowing that I can motivate people in the same way that he motivated me was so full circle for me. And hopefully just one kid from my background thinks, I might start an apprenticeship, or I might try a little bit harder in my S5 exams this year, or I might join a gym and take personal responsibility of how I look and how I present myself to the world. If one person does that from that talk, then I've literally achieved my life's work.
Yeah, you were talking about the Queen there. What did you get to share with her on that call? Was it about your own story and, of course, the Social Mobility Foundation that you were working on?
Yeah, exactly that. Basically sharing that I grew up in a specific area and a specific environment, and because of the help of this charity and my employer, I got to change my life around for the better. And it was so nice to be so authentic with her and just not talking about the propositions that my employer sell or the services that we offer, but just talking about me, like a human story. And she took such emotive involvement in my story. She was so keen to hear about my dad and hear about, she also mentioned that she had been to my hometown, Prestwick, and it just shows you that even though the Queen is a million miles, or was a million miles away from me financially, that there were still parts of our stories that bonded us together. Again, going back to my story, that stories are the only thing that brings human together, and even the Queen could relate to me. And again, it's so important for you, I, and everyone else to share their stories, no matter where they are in life, because if they don't, they're doing role modeling a disservice. Like I said, most stories, both positively and negatively, hold lessons. And the more that we can share that, the more we can give visibility of positive outcomes, but also course correct where people are maybe going down a wrong path. And like I said, even the Queen had some sort of relatable component to my story, and we had a good giggle together as well.
Yeah.
And actually, for a funny story for the podcast, because I know it's been a bit doom and gloom, I had to rehearse with the Queen before. I'm not sure if I've told you this story, have I?
Potentially.
So I had to rehearse with the Queen's office before. So there was a gentleman who I'm still in contact with now, and she says that he says that the Queen was so fond of me, which is really nice. He said that so he had to role model the persona of the Queen in a rehearsal. So I had to speak to this guy who was like a 50-year-old or 40-year-old guy and call him Your Majesty and Her Majesty and Ma'am and treat him like the Queen. So just that's some behind the scenes kind of tour of what it's like
getting ready for it. It's like Instagram versus reality.
Yeah. So funny.
Prep versus the live show is radically different.
But you would use the voice of the Queen. It's hilarious.
You probably could do it better than most because you spent so much time with her. It's amazing. And like a lady like the Queen, even for people that aren't pro-monarchy, there was a level of respect for her beyond what there is for somebody like Charles or even William, if it is in the future, because of how she held herself. And for you to speak so highly of her, I guess it probably speaks into that in terms of you felt a connection and an understanding with her more so than if it'd been anyone else.
Yeah, I think the crown probably helped with that, being able to see the kind of transgression of her life and the services that she involved herself in, of course, over her, 80-year tenure?
Yeah, incredible. But that was one of the highlights of 2020. One of the things that brought you and I even closer together was one of the low lights of 2020 when your mum passed away, and your ability to speak about that, one, so publicly, so bravely, but also in terms of in collaboration with other people as well, our very good friend Chris Reeve, is something that I think stands out in your story. And something as potentially devastating as that hasn't derailed the fire that's been lit in you over this period, and I guess it's almost continued to be a catalyst for who you are now too.
It was entire fuel for that, mate. To go back to the age of 11, when my uncle said, David, you could be an accountant, they make a lot of money. The reason I wanted to make a lot of money wasn't from this materialistic viewpoint of having bigger and better. It was to sedate and help and provide respite to the symptoms that my mum was facing. And that could have been total financial insecurity, worrying about plating foods or paying payday loans or getting food on her back, but all the way to her not having the delights that a woman her age deserved. I vividly remember checking my mom's bank account, a grown woman's bank account, she had £5 in it. And I remember every single day having to travel to work and apply for jobs on Indeed for her so that she could get like her benefits. And it wasn't because my mom was lazy, like she wasn't lazy at all. She wanted a job, she wanted purpose, she wanted to feel important, as all humans do. She wanted a role in this world. And every single day I would apply on Indeed for one of the 5C jobs, like catering, cleaning, kiosk. And every single day I had to revert back to her with news that she wasn't good enough to clean floors in some sort of engineering warehouse. And that was so soul destroying for her. Every single day I would chip away at her persona indirectly. So I wanted to be an accountant to give her luxuries that the neighbours had, to give her social status and importance and experiences that she could talk about and be proud of. It wasn't for the flashy BMW or the Rolex or whatever else. And these things are great, and I do want all those things. But the reason I wanted to start that journey was for those.
There was a more powerful motivator behind that, and I respect that.
And that was kind of like this kind of core theme that ran through this journey that I'd been on. I wanted to be an accountant because they make a lot of money. So in 2020, when she passed away, not only did she pass away, so did that North Star. Like the whole construct that I had been developing for myself died alongside her. And I always take stock when I tell this story, and I'm glad that you mentioned that I do so much, and I think it's important. That was just as hard as losing her. It really, really was. Because no matter how hard I worked, what I applied myself to, no matter how I lived by those values of agency and personal responsibility, you know, if I lived them to the fullest level, I would never be able to achieve that one North Star. And I built my entire character off that. So when she passed away, so did that. And having to decide what was next for me was at first paralyzing, but then became really liberating. And that was one of the core tenets to why I started the podcast. I remember, and I was introduced to it by you, if not Chris Williamson, was the 6-Minute Diary. And I know you still use yours and I still use mine. And I just remember in my bereavement leave, which was kind of full of solitude, which was hugely important for me. And I know you are a fan of Cal Newport's work, and he describes solitude as the being absent of the input of other minds. And that gave me time to understand what was next for me. And I remember writing down, and I still write it every single day as a positive affirmation, as I want to be a leader of inspired people by leaving significant impact on communities. I want to leave a legacy that's unique and concrete. And by my mum passing away, that instilled that positive affirmation for me. And to go back to that quote that I want to read out again, the habits of a vigorous mind are formed in contending with great difficulty. When a mind is raised by scenes that engage the heart, then those qualities that would otherwise lay dormant waken to life and form the character of a superhero.
And those qualities have been awakened by
that passing. And I have vivid memories of watching my mum pass away on the floor. There's so many core memories that I have to still therapeutically deal with through journaling and through CBT that I do, and sharing my story and sharing that component of my story actually helps me move forward with it. And one of the other things that have been really helpful is I did stand-up comedy last year. I did a stand-up comedy course, and for a while I really struggled with contending with that story. I could talk about grief and my experiences of everything that happened after the event, the whole grieving process, and how I could use it for my superpower and the perspective that it gave me on how to nurture your relationship with your parents. Now, not to
just on that nurturing the relationship with your parents piece, one of the things that I've heard you speak about before is using the time that you have more so, and you were referring to a character that you were playing or working towards. And it's funny, previous guest that we've spoken to, George Armstrong, talks a lot about a character, and that quite often relates to his brother who passed away as well, well before his time too. And the character you were playing before your mum's untimely passing was someone that was working to provide for your mum in the future, not necessarily as much as he could do in the present. And I know that's something that you've spoken about that a lot of us haven't even considered before.
Yeah, and a message is probably, if there was one message that I want to purvey on this podcast, it's probably, and it's, I guess in the communities that we operate in and we learn from, we kind of fetishize, and rightly so, delayed gratification. I think you should delay gratification for everything in your life but time with family. Reap every single moment of instant gratification that you get with your mum or your dad or your grandparents, your brothers or sisters. That's the only domain I really advocate for instant gratification. It doesn't have to be. So for context sake, I was working so hard as an apprentice, and I knew when I qualify I was going to get a certain salary, and that meant I could take my mum to New York and I could give her this kind of American dream that she always wanted. And I remember wanting to do that for her 60th birthday. And she passed at the age of 58, you know. And I realized I'd bypassed on every single tea in the house, every single takeaway, every single walk around with the dog, every single little micro conversation, because I was striving for this big lavish North Star, which was take my mum to New York. But by nature of sacrificing all those things and her passing away, I missed out on both. And I know it only in retrospect now, she would rather have a tea or coffee on the couch than any trip to New York. She would have rather have an abundance of those instant gratifications than one big delayed gratification. And I need to suffer the consequences of that every single day. I am so mindful of that every single day. I paid that price.
It came from the best place though, and you know that.
I know that. I know that now, only with the tools that I have. But at the time, it was so easy to beat myself up about it.
I understand.
It was really, really, really difficult. But lucky enough, I can now transgress that lesson into podcast messages, but also relationships with my dad and my sister and friends and everyone else. You never know when, like, you or I or anyone else, and God forbid, touch wood, something could happen to us. And I think you should delay gratification with all aspects of your life, but relationships, especially with family.
Yeah, it's a really powerful lesson, and it's such a noble goal. Like, take my mum to New York for a 60th, give her the trip that she's never had. But if you're always working and that time never comes, and it's so, so hard. Albeit you have had me in tears before when you told me about one of the trips that you did manage to achieve for your mum. So it wasn't all work, thankfully.
And when I first started at my employer, I spent my entire first salary, like reduced my bank balance to zero. And that was because I took my dad to Liverpool Football Club, because he's a huge Liverpool fan. And I took my mum to Turnberry. So when my mum was a unemployed stay-at-home mum, she would often watch these adverts for Trump Turnberry on TV. And I would return from work and she would say little things like, "Oh, David, I might book a wee holiday to Trump Turnberry next week." And complete irony.
That's where the comedian gene came from in you, I think.
So
she had better patter than anyone else.
Yeah, she definitely did as well. She was a beacon of light. Again, I learned a lot about cheerfulness and adversity from her. But I remember she used to say that, "I'm going to book a trip to Turnberry next week." And I know she couldn't afford it. I knew that it was never going to happen. But when I got my first salary, it was also the same month, October, as her birthday. So I wanted to spoil her. And I told her that my friend has a cafe in a town called Mabel, which is quite near Turnberry. And it was the opening night of it. So she had to dress up because she was going to get her picture taken. And even at that, she was like perked up. She wore her best dress and put her makeup on and got her hair done. And she felt just so important that someone was taking her photo. So I took her up this West Coast kind of drive towards Mabel. And on the way is Trump Turnberry, this place that she had been looking through the TV screen for so long. And I took her there for a trip. And I remember when we were going past it, she said, "Oh, there's Trump Turnberry. Look how nice it looks, blah, blah, blah." And as I put the indicator in and went through the gate, she just burst out crying. She never thought a woman like her belonged in a place like that. And the whole day, she just lapped it up. And you see you and I reshare on our birthdays. And
the photo of the two of you, I said, it's beautiful.
It's the fondest memory I have. And I just wish I had more micro and macro moments just like that. That's the only core memory that I really have of my mum that I can recount. And I just wish I had way more of those moments, whether it was just a wee selfie on the couch or in Costa. And yeah, I'm not saying to your listeners not to spoil your parents, but don't do it at the cost of the micro moments. Like I said, my mum would have rather had 100 of those teas and coffees than one trip to Turnberry or one trip to New York. But I was really grateful that I had the opportunity to have one of those highlights with her as well. And I know there's maybe listeners who are like, "Trump Turnberry, I go there every week, like it's no big deal." But to her, that was like the pinnacle. She had seen that place all of her life and she had never felt like she belonged or could even visit there. So it was so important to her, especially when her character and her purpose and her view of self was so poor because of the
rejections the rejection. That you were bringing through the employment search.
Exactly. Yeah. So she felt so important for that day. And she lapped it up. I'll show you after. There's so many amazing photographs of her there. She just felt like a superstar.
Yeah.
And she deserved it. She is a superstar.
Yeah, it's incredible. And before I asked you to recount that, we were talking about your use of comedy since then and the stand-up course that you did. How important has that been in, one, the grieving process, but two, also your overall skill set in life?
It's been tremendous. It's been one of my most favourite kind of side quests that I've ever embarked on. And how it's been important in terms of the grievance process is that I remember when I signed up for the course, they asked you to pick kind of a main theme or a main body to talk about. And for some reason, this experience with my mum really came to mind. And for context sake, I got a call whilst I was at the gym saying that my mum took a heart attack or at least collapsed and I had to rush home. So the whole end-to-end process I saw, I witnessed my mum essentially lose her life in my childhood home. And as you can hear from my voice and Colin's face, that's quite disturbing to recount and to comprehend. But I did a stand-up comedy set kind of making light of the whole end-to-end situation, which sounds incredibly dark, and it completely is. But by nature of me being able to address this really difficult moment in my life, if not the most difficult moment in my life, with a lens of humor, it gave my brain or gave myself permission to go back to some of the individual memories that I saw with a lens that was not sadness and it wasn't grief. It was looking for the funnies in those moments, and it allowed me to address the whole end-to-end story and revisit it. And as a result, I started going to therapy. I visited Paul in the studio for a few sessions immediately after that. But first I had to laugh.
So interesting.
It is really interesting. Really, really interesting. But that's always bonded me and my sister together. We've always had a really dark sense of humor. It's how we praise and love each other, is through making light of dark times. And I think that's why so many people go to comedy clubs. Like, they don't watch stand-up specials at home, really, but they go to a comedy club. And I think it's a level of shared suffering. A lot of the best comedians have been through trauma, addiction, grief, and everything else in between. And they make light of those situations, and the audience laugh in a collective, and it's a sense of shared suffering. So that was incredibly helpful for me to address what I'd been through. And also, like, being able to joke about that stuff and people laugh about it, it feels great. It was amazing. I got to support or be in the gig with one of my favourite Scottish comedians, Darren Connell. He does a really great show in Glasgow, and he gave me a hand up, or to use that term again, to jump on his show and share some of my sets. So it's been amazing from a kind of outcome point of view, but it's also given me the ability to kind of diffuse situations as well, both professionally and personally.
Humor's a hell of a shield, isn't it?
It's a hell of a drug.
But it's a shield too, a shield sometimes, well. Yeah, if you don't want to go somewhere.
It is.
You joked in this discussion, oh, my dad maybe couldn't string a sentence together in English, and then you went, oh, that's me using humor. Yeah. It's good you recognize that.
Yeah, and I think I've said that to you in our WhatsApp messages probably on a weekly basis. I always often apologize when we talk about something serious and I take a complete left turn with some humor.
Yeah.
It is a huge shield. It is a huge shield at the same time. It is both the sword and the shield. It can be your sword to address some of those challenges, but also when new challenges might arise, you might use humor to...
It's like deflect, isn't
to
it?
To deflect it. I've not really thought about it like that.
I thought we'd come up with something new, Jonas. But yeah, I think your ability to laugh and then to go and explore what it means in a deeper level is something that people will be intrigued by.
Yeah.
And the fact that you were able to make light of such a tragic moment and gain solace from the laughter of others, and maybe people can relate to the story or relate to elements of it, it's a positive from a real negative.
Yeah, it's releasing tension in the audience. Because they might have had a predisposition of what certain scenarios in their life meant to them and their character. And having someone, again, just much like the podcast, or going back to my school, just having someone that's quite relatable to them talk about those subjects probably provide them with a lot of comfort and solace in a room where they're sharing that solace with other people. I can imagine it's really close to the feelings of like an AA meeting when someone goes up and talks about their experiences and everyone just goes, I'm not alone. And perhaps there's synergies between my podcast, an AA meeting, and a comedy club, which I never thought I'd ever say.
Yeah, we can build into one of your sets. But I guess to hark back to the social mobility piece or the development by David piece, you are somebody that stands up and speaks at events about social mobility. You're somebody that hosts a podcast. You're somebody that speaks in a stand-up environment, which is probably one of the biggest fears for so many people. Like, public speaking is one, but stand-up comedy is probably above that because you have to get a laugh or die.
And I've asked you to do it a few times as well.
I know, we'll see one day. I don't think I'm funny, but we'll find out. But let's think back to stuttering David in school. Can we join the dots somewhere? Like, what do you think enabled that?
Forced repetition, almost. I remember being in school and taking sick days during solo talks and stuff like that because I was very deeply ashamed of how I spoke. Again, also not having a point of view either. So I think by developing a point of view, which is, I believe, in a better quality of outcomes and education and emotions for people from my background, having that as a kind of core tenant and having that positive affirmation that I write every single day, having a North Star, finding my voice, having a core set of values allowed me to have a voice. It gave me the confidence to have a voice, at least. And then in terms of sharpening the skills, forced repetition, putting myself in the most uncomfortable environments.
Exposure therapy,
exactly, mate. Creating that David Goggins callus of the mind almost. And I was looking back at some of my old footage in 2017 doing my very first talk in front of a room of like four people and I'm still stuttering, I'm awful. And then just seeing the transgression of continuous improvement between there and now, that's taken maybe 100 to 150, no, maybe more than that. I've done 100 episodes, 100 public speaking gigs, 20 gigs, like stand-up comedy, and then whatever else in between meetings and everything else. That's taking... I think you might have heard this in a previous episode that I did, storytelling reps. And I really think finding your voice or telling a story or just having a point of view is like training biceps at a gym. You go in quite feeble, unpumped. You start lifting the weights, you tear the muscle, and you go to almost failure. And it's very traumatic physically, almost. It's exhaustive. You almost have no reps in reserve in that analogy. And then you sleep, you recover, and then the next day, it's grown like one layer, like in terms of fibers, bigger and better and stronger. And then you go again and you continuously do this. And over the course of 6 to 12 weeks or 6 to 12 months, you have this fully formed bicep almost. And I feel it's the same as building your story or having a point of view or learning how to publicly speak. You put this, you go in this kind of transformation of like sharing your story, which is often traumatic and sore and exhaustive, and you're trying to make sense of it and you can't tie the knots just yet, you can't come to a radical conclusion just yet, but you're just
you're getting at the edges,
you're at the fringes, and then one day it will just click, it will just make sense and it'll be like a bookend to it almost. But you have to expose yourself. and on numerous occasions in spaced repetition or forced repetition. And that's how stand-up comedy sets are born. It's almost like this, I always use this kind of body transformation analogy where it starts off as this kind of overweight, obese, skinny, fat David McIntosh at the age of 13. This is a stand-up comedy set. And then you go into different open mics and different gigs, and what starts as like a 120 kilo David ends up at this really lean 5% body fat, 60 kilograms David, because you start to eradicate the fat and what doesn't really add value.
You're chipping away.
You're chipping away, and at the end you've got this final
more chiseled polished form.
Yeah, like a Greek statue almost, and that's the version that you present to the world. But you have to accumulate and do the bulking season to understand what is strong and mighty underneath.
Yeah, I want to talk about one of those bulking season episodes where you had an interesting experience in Tenants Bar of all places.
Oh, I didn't think you'd bring this up. Exposing. Yeah, so again, it might...
I think this will be helpful for people to understand the journey of stand-up, but also the journey of dealing with what you've dealt with.
Yeah, so I remember when I first moved to Glasgow, which was January or February 2023 this year, I started doing some open mic nights, and I performed that set about my mum at an open mic in Merchant City. And there's a couple of lads in who promote and host events or comedy events in Glasgow. And one of them said, "Oh, David, I really loved your set. I would love to for you to do it at Tenants Bar in the West End." And of course, I was two or three gigs and I was full of pride and maybe ego at the time. I was so proud that I was on a paid gig or like a postered gig. For the first time, Saturday Night Live at Tenants. So I shared the poster on Facebook that had my face on it, my name on it, and added the ticket link, not thinking that anyone I would know would actually turn up. And I just moved to the West End of Glasgow, and I got a message from my two cousins who are from my hometown, and they said, "David, we're at Top Golf this weekend. We're going to the pubs afterwards. I see that you're performing stand-up. We're going to buy some tickets and come and watch you." And of course, being two gigs in, not really finding my voice in the comedy scene, I shit myself. I physically shit myself. And I said to them, I lied to them. I said, "I've just moved into my new flat. I'm coming off the bill. I don't really have the time to be on it tonight." So I left it at that. And the next day I headed towards the gig that I lied to them about. And I was with Lewis McFarlane, who's been on the show, and a few other mates. And I got a message saying, "Well, David, we're actually at the comedy club just to watch anyway. Why don't you pop along for a pint?" So I had to then admit to them that I'm actually on the bill. So it was after, I think, an Old Firm game. So there was quite a lot of rowdy participants. I'm not going to tell you what side they were from at that gig. And because I had sold more tickets than maybe some of the other comedians, they bumped me up to before the pro headliner on like my second or third gig. And every single comedian was going up and, to use the stand-up term, dying on their arse. And that's just not getting laughs. The audience being really rowdy.
Getting heckled.
And almost to the point where the comedians were fighting with the audience. But also my cousins were getting progressively more drunk. And they were getting really rowdy and they were getting picked on. And they were taking me up to the stage and getting selfies with me. And I was kind of cringing because I'd been trying to navigate myself into the new tribe of the comedians that were there. And I remember going up on stage and sharing this set about my mum. And of course, they see me as this social mobility poster boy on Facebook that's very clean cut.
Really polished.
Speaking like how I speak now, and I go up and do this dark set. And I just see throughout the progression of the set, their face just falling more and more into grimace. And they're starting to get annoyed that other people are laughing at their dead auntie. And I walk off stage and I just say, like, I don't even finish my set. And I just say to them, "That's all I've got tonight, ladies and gentlemen." And I just hang up the microphone and I walk off and I just see them come up to me and kind of nod and be like, "Oh, that was good, David." And they just bolt upstairs thereafter. And we don't really speak in good terms that much. Oh, they do. They like things on Facebook and say happy birthday and stuff. But we're not as close as we once were. But that's just nature of it, right? The people that weren't involved in those events found it hilarious.
We're laughing along.
And it's bizarre how when you have like emotional skin in the game, how much your opinions are skewed.
Well, you see this nowadays with like cancellation of comics, don't you?
Yeah.
People who didn't attend the gig are somehow massively offended or aren't related to it in any way.
Yeah, and they'll laugh at all the other jokes that don't relate to something very personal that they have been
through. Oh, that comedian's really funny, but when he said that, that's a no-go.
Yeah.
I remember once at university, we went to the Stand Comedy Club next to Glasgow Uni, so it's like a Tuesday night open mic. I genuinely think it was like £3 or something for entry with a student card. This is a long time ago because I'm quite old. But Frankie Boyle came in.
Aww.
And he was already really well known by this point, but it was quite well known that he would often try out new material. and some of it was like,
especially 10 years ago, Frankie Boyle 10 years ago was rogue. That was kind of like Mock the Week Frankie Boyle.
It was so dark. Like, he made a few jokes, like Michael Jackson jokes, like paedophilic jokes, and the crowd was laughing. Then he made a Princess Diana joke, mm-hmm. and it went down like a lead balloon, and he was like, okay, interesting, that's where your line is. Then he made a Madeleine McCann joke, went down like a lead balloon, and he was like, oh, interesting, that's where the line is. And he was just testing and probing, but people were laughing at that comedian making a joke about paedophilia in relation to Michael Jackson, but when they made a joke in paedophilia in relation to Madeleine McCann, that wasn't okay. So it was really interesting to see, like you say, where the line is drawn, and from the same person with relatively similar innuendo, one was okay and one wasn't, and the crowd were like viscerally like offended by this. So I can see why when you make a joke and they're fine with parts of it, they have a problem with the rest.
What also really helps, which a lot of comedians do, is like self-deprecation up front as well. Like, I always slag myself before I slag the events that I've been through and other people on my sets. And I think that's really important because it kind of gives you permission to then kind of play at the edges.
In terms of self-depreciation though, like, your actual self-talk nowadays compared to young David is so much stronger. What recommendations would you give people to try and get to that level?
Oh, I think being aware of it as well. I don't imagine many people actually take stock of their self-talk. They probably think it's this kind of pre-programmed operating system that they always rely on. But in fact, you can control that. We've often spoke about the analogy of having a noisy roommate. And that is, you're in a monologue and you can either choose to become friends with it or change it. So I think, what advice would I give? I think first is identify it. I think that's hugely important, but also give yourself the advice that you'd give your best friend. You wouldn't talk to your best friend by calling them a loser or not good enough, or
you always do
ugly.
This.
You always do this, and this is why these things happen. And I remember I take stock when I know I'm going through a depressive episode. I've never suffered from depression, but I've had periods of low mood, and the greatest trigger or identifier that I'm going through that period is how I talk to myself. I think I may have said this to you before, and it's usually around burnout as well when I'm going through that, and I take stock of that. And I have to rationalize, is this true? Are the things that I'm saying about myself accurate? What are the evidence? What is the evidence that stacks this up as a representative example? And then I take stock of that and decide whether it's true or not. But I also think about, would my best friend say this about me? Or would I say this about my best friend? No. So why am I saying it to myself? I think Peterson probably talks about this. Treat yourself.
Yeah, rule two in the first 12 rules for the like book is like, speak to yourself like somebody you're responsible for helping. And it's a great framework. And that's a more, even more relatable one. And the way you've spoken there, like, you're like, it's kind of taking a helicopter view. Like, we've all heard that wanky corporate term, a helicopter management, but like, that's like a helicopter view of, why am I speaking to myself like this? Would somebody else say the same? Is there evidence? And it's creating that detachment from the noisy roommate at that moment in time, and like, oh, that noisy roommate, like you say, I can either choose to agree with what they're saying based on fact, or I can challenge it, or I can just completely change the narrative if I decide to.
And maybe sometimes what you're telling yourself is in fact true. Maybe you are overweight and you're not confident about it, or you're not comfortable about it. Maybe you are financially insecure and you're not comfortable or confident about it. So it might actually be an indication that you need to make a radical change in your life. That could be from a point of, for example, I remember, to use a tangible example, I was living at home since the age of 80, well, for my entire life up to the age of 25. But specifically after my mum passed away, I was living at home because I wanted to be there for my dad. I've spoken about the kind of depression and alcoholism. I wanted to be there for him. So I was living through his necessity opposed to my own necessity. And what that was creating for me is, well, I wasn't really proud about the environment, so I didn't want to bring friends over. I wasn't really proud about it either because I couldn't bring relationships or girlfriends or girls over. It wasn't conducive to a routine that was paramount to the person that I wanted to become. And I just had kind of ambient shame of how it looked. So that manifested itself into me talking a certain way about myself. You don't have a girlfriend, you don't have friends coming over, and you're not like getting,
you're not
up
house proud.
Yeah, and you're not getting up at 6 a.m. and doing all these things. And then that was a signal to me that I had to make a change. And which I did in January. I moved out to the west end of Glasgow, which is a very community-led, kind of vibrant area. I started mingling with more women. I started developing my friendship group, doing stand-up comedy, living a
happy to host people at the flat to have a coffee before you go out, whatever.
I even did my 100th podcast episode in the flat, which is incredible because I had such deep shame about where I grew up.
Again, that's why for some people that's not a step, but for young David, that's why it means a lot more. And that's why, like, when sometimes we have conversations, you'll say stuff like, oh, like, I'm really, like, proud if, like, my younger self could see me now. Mm-hmm. And that's relevant based on the start point, not on the midpoint or the end point. It's based on that. And one of the things that we both talk about is trying to be as happy as possible with less.
Yeah.
And that's not to say relinquishing material desires, like, he spoke about the BMW, I've spoken about the Rolex and stuff like that. These are all things that I consciously knew I wanted, but I do still get a buzz from drinking the new energy drinks that we've had access to recently, going and hitting the gym session. We've gone to gym and Nando's together and it's been like a great day. We've had a great time.
That's but like it a wasn't tenor, right?
But yeah, but it wasn't like chasing some sort of new hedonic high that we've never had before, because there's a level of trying to achieve contentment through relatively basic entry level things.
And it's like that Naval Ravikant quote, if you're not happy with a coffee, you won't be happy with a yacht.
I really believe that, and I think that's why we're both pretty level happy individuals.
Yeah,
but yeah, and speaking of happy individuals, I'm really happy with the conversation we've just had. I hope you're happy too, mate.
Me too. It's, like I said, a full circle moment for me, given the fact that I was a fan and a follower and now a guest on the podcast. That just shows for me, again, not to sound narcissistic or egotistical, this is a feedback loop to myself. Look where I started. I started as someone that, you like I said, you shouldn't have. I had this perception that you shouldn't be in contact with me, and now I'm on the
shouldn't be replying to you, which I think is mad, but which, yeah, I understand that.
And now I'm on the podcast sharing my story. I need to, again, thinking about my inner monologue, I need to think about that distance traveled. I could easily think, well, I'm not on Rogan, I'm not on Stephen Bartlett, I'm not on Chris Williamson. But in fact, I'm on a podcast that I once listened to and was a fan of, and like, that is successful to me. And I can use that evidence, that stack of proof, that I don't need to talk to myself in those certain ways. So I'm really proud of this episode. I'm really proud to be a guest because, again, for me, it's a line in the sand showing distance traveled. So thank you for the opportunity to do that, mate.
Yeah, that relative success is huge, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because in 5 years' time, you'll want to go on the next thing and whatever else, and that's
how we're all back on Rogan. You'll be on the now feeling after that.
Yeah, we'll see, man. We'll see. But yeah, thank you so much, David. If people want to continue the conversation with you, where should they head towards?
Development by David on Instagram. Shoot me a message, shoot me a DM, follow me, follow you back, I'll message you back.
And wherever you listen to your podcasts, if you listen to this one, Apple, Spotify, YouTube, you can find your podcast as well.
Yeah, the Development by David podcast.
Beautiful. Thanks. Thank you, David. And thank you to you, the listener. I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.